For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Earlier this week, the leader of the state Senate said he wanted a more thorough approach to vetting nominations from the governor to the state Senate. This would be a far cry from years past when most nominations sail through without questions or debate. But it also comes at a time when the governor has many more nominations with the addition of agency heads as well as boards and commissions. Ryan, is this a welcome idea or will it slow down the process?
Well, I think that if it does slow down the process, that in and of itself may be welcome. And, you know, this is the assertion of power by the legislative branch. We've seen, you know, Governor Stitt has probably more than any governor, maybe in the history of Oklahoma, but, you know, certainly in the last several decades, has asserted the executive power like no other governor. And what we're seeing, you know, whether that's just through the sheer force of his personality and, you know, being, you know, up in legislative offices, negotiating deals himself, or through legislation that has consolidated actual ability for him to make unilateral decisions in some instances with who heads these state agencies. So the legislature, and I've talked about this as these pieces of legislation move forward, that the legislature at some point is going to have to assert itself, or it's going to risk losing a lot of oversight and accountability to the executive branch. You know, they may like Governor Stitt, and they may be simpatico on who they want to fill these key positions, but that may not always be the case. You may have a Democratic legislature. You may have a Democratic governor at some point. You may have Republican governors that have a different idea of a Republican legislature. And being able to assert that separate but co-equal branch of government status that the legislative branch has under our state constitution is incredibly important. So taking this seriously, vetting these folks, asking a lot of questions, even if it slows it down, I think it's important for the democratic process in Oklahoma.
Neva.
And I think this process, I think, does match with what the governor is doing. I mean, when you have a governor now with appointments of 160-plus appointments, ultimately, that will need Senate confirmation, he's put forward, I think, 66, 67, somewhere in that number so far. But only a handful have been confirmed. So I think by setting in place, what we've got a couple of things happening simultaneously. We've got a new governor coming in with a lot of appointments, just like we see at the federal level, a president with lots of appointments that have to be made. And it's a very fast track trying to get folks in place so that they can continue to get the work done. But I think the vetting process with the Senate taking this approach that's very similar to the U.S. Senate by making sure that each of these nominees goes and individually meets with the members on the committee beforehand. The committee has an opportunity to really sit and ask some thoughtful questions if there are issues or just getting to better know and understand the background and whether this person really has a handle on the position that they've been nominated for. And then I think prioritizing the scale of the nominees, as Pro Tem Treat said, where if you have folks that are going to hold in state government agency heads, cabinet secretaries, or members of the Board of Regents of OU, OSU, that these folks obviously take a higher priority because they're in a much greater position of responsibility. And I think when, as we've talked about before, the governor equally has clearly taken a very thoughtful process in making these appointments and selections because they come back on him ultimately. We talk about with the power goes the responsibility of making sure that these folks are people that you want to actually carry out what you envision and have goals for those particular agencies and key leaders. So I think we're seeing a lot of things happen quickly. I think the long and the short, though, in terms of the process is they'll pick up steam, as Treat said this week. I mean, we'll pick up a lot of steam in the next 2 weeks. I think we'll see a lot of these roll through. And frankly, I think with probably very few exceptions, they will be unanimously moved through the committees and on to the full vote in the Senate.
And you know, I don't think that that's going to change. We've seen these appointments in the past usually get the green light. You know, there's really no opposition. What we may see in this is that a more thorough vetting could result in folks being withdrawn You know, so I don't think that we'll move forward with contention. I don't think this is going to be a situation where we see like in the United States Senate where we move forward with contentious nominees and you have like a really divided vote. I think more than likely, you know, during that vetting process, if you don't have some consensus, you're probably going to have folks withdrawn because you don't want to, what we don't want to move is towards a system that is much more partisan and much more contentious and really use this as an opportunity to build relationships between lawmakers and these agency heads.
And oftentimes they float those trial balloons long before they even nominate someone right. to make sure that there isn't anything that's going to backfire. They're going to have, opposition that they weren't aware of. So I think that this is a process that the public, by and large, doesn't pay much attention to, but I think it is a serious process within the ranks of not only the legislature, but in the governor's office, making sure that these things go not only smoothly, but take the, as you say, it's not time-driven. It needs to be properly vetted so that everyone makes sure that at the end of it, they know who these folks are.
The Oklahoma High Court is losing another justice as the U.S. Senate approves the nomination of Patrick Weirich to the federal bench in Oklahoma City. With the resignation of John Reif at the end of this month, it puts new Governor Kevin Stitt in line to put two new people on the Oklahoma Supreme Court. Neva, this is a pretty big deal for the new leader.
It's a big, big deal. And I think, first of all, I mean, from the standpoint of getting this appointment through, it's taken a year. And I think we only saw it this week, and it was on a party line vote, Republicans only voting for Justice Weirich. But that it came as a result of a rule that was pushed through the Senate last week by Senator Langford and others that allowed for a vote for his nomination and for some of these other district judgeships. I mean, getting these things hung up where they cannot move these through the process in the Senate is just regrettable. And a year is a long time, and now we still have another position still vacant in the Western District, and we'll see how long that goes. So, it's clear that there's always going to be this partisan divide. There's always going to be this give and take in the United States Senate, but there has to be a better way to ultimately move these folks through so we can get these positions with not only filled, but not have this just abrasive back and forth exchange that seems to be nonstop in the past year.
Ryan.
Justice Weirich's confirmation by the United States Senate, this is a part of a 40-plus year plan of the Federalist Society and other conservative legal organizations to build a conservative legal bench. And boy, are they doing it. I mean, in Trump's first couple of years in office, he has flipped a couple of circuit courts ideologically and pretty dramatic ways. Other circuit courts have changed ideologically quite a bit. You know, when he came into office, and we often talk about the United States Supreme Court, those are the ones that get all the attention. But when Trump took office, there were 107 additional judicial vacancies over and above the United States Supreme Court. Ronald Reagan, by contrast, had 35 unfilled, and Obama had 54. And Trump has moved with great speed. The Obama administration did an abysmal job of advancing judicial nominees and left a huge number of these vacancies just because they weren't aggressive. What we've seen in the Trump administration and the Republican Senate under Leader McConnell is they are moving with great speed and really won't let anything stand as a roadblock in their way. It may have taken a year to get Weirich on the bench, but it's part of a much larger movement to create a conservative judiciary that, frankly, I mean, Donald Trump could be defeated in the 2020 presidential election, but his legacy, the longest lasting legacy of this presidency, is going to be in the courts. And, we're talking 20, 40, 60 years because we're seeing folks appointed like Justice Weirich, who are incredibly young, going on the bench. They're going to be there for a very long time. And even after they're gone, the precedents that they set are going to live on beyond their tenure on the bench.
Meanwhile, what does it mean for the Oklahoma Supreme Court with two nominees from Stitt?
It means immediately that that Governor Stitt is going to be able to start making his mark on the court. I mean, these will be very significant appointments. And I think when you look at Justice Reif leaving and now with the Justice Weirich moving, some say lateral, but moving to the federal bench, it will present an opportunity for on a couple of fronts. And I think the interesting kind of thing in the mix here that will have some legislative consequence is this redistricting proposal that is still alive mm-hmm. and moving through the process. clearly would appear, you know, on the surface to be kind of a rural-urban a split philosophically, even among Republican members. But the governor's weighed in and certainly has been lobbying on this issue. One has a point of view that he wants to see realized. So how that influences this process ultimately could make a difference on where that justice, where the new justice could come from, I mean, geographically. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of things at play here, and certainly I think when we talk about the courts, I mean, you're right, Ryan, philosophically, oftentimes, particularly partisan voters, I mean, when they look at a president or a presidential campaign, the makeup of who that person is in the White House and their influence on the Supreme Court and all of the federal judiciary is a significant point. I mean, polls clearly show that. The voters do understand philosophically, is it going to lean to the left or the right, is going to mirror who's in the White House. And so this has been significant with the Trump administration.
And Ryan, it does show that elections has its consequences if Democrats lose and Governor Stitt is the one who's picking the Supreme Court.
Absolutely. And I think it remains to be seen exactly who's going to have Governor Stitt's ear on this appointment process. I don't know. I mean, during the campaign trail, anytime you talk about the courts, obviously, you know, the one question that everybody gets is abortion. You know, they want to know, are you going to appoint pro-life judges, whatever that means? You know, I think that, you know, that, you know, whoever he appoints will probably check that box in some way, shape or form. You know, but at the end of the day, what else really is guiding the way that he's going to select these judges? I remember visiting with Governor Brad Henry shortly after he left office and talking about his legacy. And he didn't skip a beat whenever he said one of the most important legacies that he left were the judicial appointments that he made while he was in office. And many of those Henry judges are still on the bench today, but you know, some of them are beginning to roll off. And you know, so these are the really big decisions that are going to outlast both President Trump, outlast Governor Stitt.
And in a nine member court, I mean, it's with two early appointments in the Stitt first term. It would be interesting to see, will there be others? I mean, there's a lot of speculation. I mean, that there very well could be a third coming along, you know, in the not too distant future. Whether that happens or not, I think the significance for the governor and what we've seen already in his appointments and nominees is clearly a situation where the governor wants to be the person making that decision. He'll take a lot of input, but at the end of the process, I think it's the governor making up his own mind of who he feels most comfortable with that can move his vision forward for Oklahoma.
Oklahoma City swears in its newest council members, including Ward 2's James Cooper, who is not only the first openly gay councilor, but also the first African-American elected outside of Ward 7. Ryan, Cooper was welcomed in a rally Monday night by the LGBTQ community, but also Mayor David Holt.
And let's think about the contrast of just where we are in 2019. First of all, congratulations to James Cooper, to the new city council woman, Jo Beth Hammond. You know, right now we have five of the city council members under 40 right now. I mean, this is this is the most diverse and inclusive representation of Oklahoma City residents on their city council that they've ever seen. So, I mean, Jo Beth, congratulations. James, congratulations. You know, Nikki Nice, who came in the special election. I mean, these are all incredible, incredible moments for the city of Oklahoma City. And David Holt, you know, I've been telling folks that David Holt, I think, has the most promising political future of any person in the state of Oklahoma right now. And what he showed on swearing in on the march the day before the swearing in, he wasn't just, you know, standing on the steps of City Hall. He came down. He was out talking with folks. He was out embracing James Cooper. He said, "We love James Cooper. We think he's awesome." Compare that to 2001. Go back to 2001 when Kirk Humphries, mayor of Oklahoma City, literally had to be sued to allow the Cimarron Alliance to put up pro-LGBTQ banners for Pride that year. You know, he was saying that, you know, we can't have this. It's an abomination. This is not representative of our community. And, you know, it was tantamount to obscenity to even recognize that Oklahoma City had LGBT residents in its midst. And so from 2001 to 2019, when Mayor Holt is out embracing the first openly gay city council member in Oklahoma City. What a sea change. I don't think I could have ever imagined that we would have had progress happen this fast.
Neva.
Well, and I think it reflects the kind of the changing demographics of the Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've talked about that for a long time, the political ramifications of it turning purple. I mean, you know, the changing, the kind of the not only the changing demographics, but in terms of looking toward the future, when you have a younger mayor and you have someone who is high energy casting, you know, this not only big vision for the city, but really putting the time and energy behind it. And I think you're right. I mean, I think he certainly is a politician who is kind of out there every day. You almost can't miss this guy. I mean, wherever you turn, I mean, and however you get your information and your news and your communication, he is someone who is out there telling the story of Oklahoma City, telling it here and telling it across the country and internationally. So I think it's a bright future for Oklahoma City, a lot of things happening in a big way. Now I think with these new members comes the opportunity to build a consensus with all of the members of the council to try to determine what are the next steps in the next maps and all of the other things that are on the horizon. It will take shape in a way that it can't just be driven by age or any other, you know, any other factor. It has to be what is best for the total picture of Oklahoma City as a whole. And I think that's where, you know, ward representation is important. There's been a lot of discussion through the years that maybe there needs to be additional restructuring, and maybe this comes with redistricting in 2021. Maybe we look at the ward map and we decide that that there's a different configuration to allow for even broader representation down the road. So, but all in all, I would say you have to applaud the effort of these folks that not only have taken the initiative to run and be successful, but now looking forward what they can do for the future of Oklahoma City.
It was also cool to see James Cooper at the steps of this rally with now former Councilman Ed Shadid, a former political opponent of his. And so when you look at James Cooper and the seat that he's taken over, I mean, what, you know, go back to Sam Bowman and then, you know, kind of in the vein of Ed yes. Shadid yeah. and then, you know, the Pete Whites on the city council. I mean, they used to be kind of the outsiders, right? You know, you had Shadid and White or Bowman, you know, they would be kind of the contrarian on the council. But now I think that we have a council made up of folks, of community activists, of teachers, of people that, you know, not regardless of their demographic background, their occupational background, the work that they've thrown themselves into before they come to the council. I think we're going to see a very different tone at the city council, and I think that will match a lot of the tone that's set by Mayor Holt.
Lawmakers were busy this week leading up to another deadline. Lawmakers had to get legislation out of the opposing chamber's committee. I just want your thoughts on any measures which did or didn't get through the latest deadline. Neva, let's start with you.
Well, I think, you know, one of the high priority bills that Speaker McCall had earlier in the week went down in flames with a 0-9 vote in committee and in the Senate Transportation Committee, and this kind of set up a scuffle back and forth on what happened in terms of bills moving in or out as a result of that. I think it's
having trains stop at
that's right, I think it's a case of where now we're seeing in this kind of this last throes of what's going to finally make it through the process and stay alive and be able to come down to the wire and possibly make it to the governor's desk. I think we have a situation where that coupled with there's been this conversation that the budget negotiations had been going fairly smoothly. Maybe we were 80% was the figure that we were hearing, that it was about 80% complete. After kind of these skirmishes and these give and takes in some of the committees this week, you know, some people suggest that number's gone down. It may be more 50 to 60%. Maybe it's not quite going to be so easy and quick sledding. So I think what we have now is this normal process with a lot of new faces. Let's remember, it's new for the governors. people and the governor himself. It's new for a lot of lawmakers that are freshmen going through this first session, and we'll see what that really looks like in terms of the outcome now that we're going to start talking about money and where these allocations are going to finally come.
Right.
You know, I think criminal justice reform is still, you know, alive. There are many mm-hmm. important bills, pretrial justice reform, reforming the bail system, reforming the way that juries are allowed to impose alternatives to incarceration.
Retroactivity
of 7-8. You know, those things are all still alive, but they all have significant procedural hurdles ahead of them. So they've passed out of committee. They have floor votes. There's probably a conference committee ahead of them. And what we're seeing now is, you know, organizations and a coalition, Oklahomans for Criminal Justice Reform, that's made up of a number of organizations that have been working on this issue for many years. And they're out front with the legislature, and legislators are now beginning to have some concern about, you know, what are these things going to ultimately look like that we vote on? And a lot of those decisions right now, unfortunately, as we've seen in years past, are starting to be made behind closed doors. And the folks that are behind those closed doors, you know, there's some hope there, but there's also things to be discouraged about. You know, Tim Downing, who's a former state lawmaker, former assistant attorney general, no friend of State Question 780, and one of the biggest leaders in the opposition to criminal justice reform, is part of this working group now in the Secretary of State's office that is working with the governor to help craft criminal justice reform, which seems counter entirely to Governor Stitt's message of wanting to shake things up. He wanted to get rid of the status quo. Well, here you've got this career government bureaucrat who's made a career out of opposing criminal justice reform and carrying water for district attorneys. He's now in that mix, you know. So
meanwhile, you had criminal prosecutors actually going to the Capitol the earlier this week and saying, you know, we're forgetting about the crime victims when we pass these corrections reforms.
Well, and they're not mutually exclusive. I mean, I think that saying that crime victims are justification for unreasonable criminal sentences, unreasonable criminal justice policies, that's just, you know, that's a red herring. And, you know, I think that they've rolled that out in years past, where they try to say that, you know, what we're doing here is a disservice to victims. What victims want are safer communities, they want justice, and what we have right now just simply isn't justice. What the real question right now, because you hear this out at the Capitol right now, is from folks that are trying to slow down criminal justice reform movements, is that we're moving too fast. And I think that the real question is, how is it that you can defend the status quo? How can you say that we're not moving fast enough? Because that's the real question, because the status quo right now is indefensible. And unfortunately, we're starting to see some of the same defenders of the status quo, like Tim Downing, continue to rear their head at the state capitol on this issue.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.